our scripture for today that Isaac is going to preach on is John 13, 1 through 17. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you will have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them."
Good morning, everyone. How's everyone doing? Gotta get rid of some of this. Couple things before I start. Regarding the building, I thought about doing a sermon on all of that today, but wanted to give a little bit of time to reflect and think about that before we start talking about it, or before I start talking about it anyways. And so I'll be preaching next week also, and that's when I'll discuss a little more, or at least that will be more involved. So if you're wondering why I'm not really talking about that, that's why. Second, did I say my name yet? I'm so bad at these. I'm Isaac Horwittle, on staff at the Mercy House, part-time Sunday speaker. And I realize I've done this a few times and never given anyone a way to contact me. If you have, like, questions about something I've said, or complaints or comments or any of those things, I don't have an official Mercy House email address, but it's just isaachorwittle@gmail.com. And if you need the spelling on that, you'll just have to talk to me in person anyway. So you can also come talk to me if you have those types of comments afterward. But I just wanted to make that clear. So John 13, 1 through 17. I think there's a tendency within most people groups, churches, religious groups, non-religious groups, to get so accustomed to their own symbols and traditions that the practices lose a great deal of their original meaning. I don't think this is always a bad thing. The societal and cultural symbols are prone to change, and sometimes they have to change to get back their original meaning or some of the meaning and influence on the group that describes those symbols and traditions they're worth. For example, this summer I've been attending and will continue to attend a lot of weddings. And candles will be lit, rings will be exchanged, flowers will be tossed, and garters will be removed. I'm not exactly sure how that all happens. And honestly, I have no idea how most of these symbols and traditions originated. Regardless, some of them, like the rings, for instance, They're relatively easy to understand, even if I don't know the exact origin. The ring is circular, it doesn't end, like the love of the two people getting married. And I don't know if that's how it was originally thought of, but for the most part, it represents that eternal vow of commitment. And the garters and all that other stuff, I really don't know, and I really can't even take much of a guess. It's just a tradition. I've seen it at weddings. I'll continue to see it at weddings, and I just sort of accept it's something that happens. And I'm sure as times change, people will opt out of doing some of those, and others will continue to do them because they're traditions, and you follow through with those. And probably someday, hundreds of years from now, if people are still getting married, I'm sure there will be new traditions with ever-evolving meanings. And I've kind of wandered off the point here. But the point is, every group has traditions. All of them will at one point or another either lose sight of these traditions or ascribe new meaning to them in an attempt to recapture them. And I'm not someone who believes that these traditions necessarily have to have some inherent meaning, but that the meaning is given. And I think it's important, though, to always be conscious of why we're doing the things we do, why we believe the things we believe, and whether or not the things we believe are matching up with the things we're doing. So John 13, 1 through 17, contains one such tradition that's become very important for Christians to relative degrees over the course of history. For some, the washing of feet is right up there with baptism, communion. For others, it's a nice symbolic gesture you might do every once in a while as a reminder that each of us should be humble to one another, that we're all on the same playing field, and so forth. For others, it's simply another story and a series of stories contained within the New Testament. And I'm not here trying to make a case for how important the practice of feet washing should be to you, and certainly not for Christians in general. And I'm also not going to make an attempt at explaining what exactly washing another person's feet means for you, or what it means that Jesus literally washed the feet of his disciples. I'm simply trying to approach the text with clear eyes, a full heart, and a mind that is open to reimagining this story in John 13, 1 through 17 for myself and our community. Again, I'm not trying to part ways with the traditional understanding. I'm not trying to come up with something original for the sake of coming up with something original. It's only that I believe there's a great temptation in reading Scripture and automatically assuming, based on one's own experience or past or tradition, that one understands the text, that one has arrived at the correct interpretation. So, to get to the passage, it begins with the narrator informing us that we're approaching the Passover festival. That's actually already kind of started. And Passover, as we may or may not know, is a time of remembrance for Israel's exodus from Egyptian captivity. This was a time of great importance, and tensions were often running pretty high for both Jews and the Romans. Jews from all around made a pilgrimage to the temple in Jerusalem. And this is the same temple that Jesus cleansed and the same one he predicted would be destroyed. So the place is crowded with a lot of people, many of whom want to overthrow the Roman government. So as to be expected, there were people who saw this as a big opportunity to do that. Others saw it as a big risk or security threat. And it's opening night of this festival, as the text says, that it was right before the Passover feast, which is a meal also called a Seder, that marks the beginning of the 7 or 8 day holiday. So Jesus already knows he's going to die, that his hour had come, that he would depart out of this world to the Father. And it says he loved his own who were in the world to the end. So Jesus sees how things are going. He can see the trajectory of his life, and it's become pretty apparent that he's going to die at the hands of the authorities. It also says that he already knows he's going to be betrayed by Judas. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to talk a lot about Judas today, partly because it would open up a really big discussion regarding the relationship between John, the book, and the synoptic gospels, Mark, Matthew, and Luke. Safe to say, it's not something I think it would be all that beneficial right now, but if you're interested in that, I can talk with you or point you in the right direction with some books. And already there are some discrepancies between John and the other Gospels. This specific story of Jesus washing the feet isn't in any of the other Gospels, and John doesn't mention anything about taking and eating of the bread and wine, but if you were to put them together, they would be around this time that in the other Gospels, the Lord's Supper is happening. But I think it's a tension we should let stay there. I think there's very little use in trying to reconcile the Gospels into one cohesive timeline. I just don't think it works. And there's no use in trying to find out which of the versions is most true or most accurate, because I think it's really problematic to read the ones we think are right and then disregard the others, or to deny the reality that they contradict from time to time. But all I know is that in John 13, Jesus washes the feet of the disciples. So what might it mean that this man we claim to believe is both a human and God, or that this God whom we claim to believe is God and yet became a human? What does it mean that he washed the feet of his disciples? This is the same God that somehow exists before, during, and after, yet who, on the other hand, doesn't exist at all in the sense of space and time. This very God stands not one amongst many objects, but wholly other, outside the grasp of our human conception. This God that we claim to believe created, that we claim to believe is still creating, the God that we claim to believe created us, this God of all peoples and all nations, supreme and everlasting, without beginning or end. This God became human, took on the flesh, as they say, and was killed by his very creation. But before they could kill him, he washed their feet. What kind of implications does this contain? Certainly, if the story had never happened, no one would doubt that Jesus suffered and was humiliated, but always wanted to take things a step or two further than expected. Jesus washes the feet of his own followers, who, logically speaking, were even lower than he was. And he was a wandering homeless Jew, leaving not always so subtle hints that he might just be the Messiah. It might not only be the Messiah, but God in the flesh. The only people crazier than a crazy man are the people following him, or so they might say. So Jesus lowers himself down below to the level of a foot scrubber, a job reserved for the lowliest slaves and servants. He's not washing the feet of kings or rulers, but other wandering homeless Jewish fishermen and social outcasts who have left friends, family, and any hope of good social standing so that they too might one day lower themselves lower than the other marginalized people they came into contact with and wash their feet. So what in God's name do we do with this? What does Jesus washing some people's feet over 2,000 years ago have to do with us? What does it have to do with our heartache and stressful jobs? What does it have to do with leaky roofs and abandoned lots and budgets dripping with red ink? What does the washing of feet have to do with your decision as to whether or not to break off your relationship or whether or not to move? What does Jesus washing the disciples' feet have to do with your emotional health and happiness and security, with our addictions and egos and insecurities? I've heard it said that the washing of feet is a way for a person doing the washing to humble themselves in a rather disagreeable act of service. It's a bit lost on us nowadays, what with cars and bicycles and shoes and sidewalks. Washing someone's feet in those days, as most of you have probably gathered and heard in multiple sermons, well, it was a bit different than it is today. People walked all over with their open-toed sandals in the dirt and mud and sludge and feces that probably got all over the roadways in those days. It made sense to wash your feet when you came inside. Today it's become little more than a symbolic act, which is fine, but it was more than a symbol back then. Jesus wasn't just lowering himself symbolically or metaphorically, but was literally taking the place of a servant or a slave. Today, when we wash someone's feet, it might smell a bit off. They might have hairy toes, as I do. I mean, feet are generally, for most of us, one of our more awkward extremities. It's not that it isn't still a symbolic gesture. I've washed feet and had my own feet washed, and it can be a very powerful experience. But it is hardly a concrete demonstration of the radical love of Christ. The same goes for communion. There's a difference between actually sitting down and breaking bread in community with others and walking up to the front of a church and dunking some store-bought bread in a bowl of juice or wine. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't do so, but I don't think these things were ever meant to be solely symbols. They were very real, concrete expressions of love. I think there are three ways I've been looking at this, and each way is kind of dependent upon the person who's coming into contact with the story. And the first two are relatively straightforward. For some people, the idea of the Almighty God washing your feet seems impossible. We're not good enough to have our feet washed by another person, let alone God. There's a sense of pride there, yeah, but there's also a sense of shame, embarrassment, and guilt. The idea is that they do not deserve to have their feet washed by someone. No, they should be the one washing someone else's feet. I'd imagine that's what most of the disciples were feeling. Jesus shouldn't wash my feet. He's the one I'm supposed to serve. If anything, I should be washing his. But Jesus is demonstrating a radical form of love in which he lowers himself and serves the one society says should be the servants. And some people need to hear that. They need to know that God loves them radically, despite their shortcomings, despite their sins, or their faults, or their failures. God's love overcomes all. But there are others who maybe don't need to hear that, but need to learn from Jesus' example that Jesus, God of love, lowered himself to become a human and then served the servants. And if Jesus could do that, then who are you not to do the same to an even greater extent? What excuse is going to match that? I'm sorry, God. I know you did this, but you don't understand. My job, I have no time. It just doesn't work. And that's right there in the text. Starting in verse 12, Jesus says, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet." So for those of us who have felt God's love, been affirmed by that, we need to be the ones washing the feet of those who believe they should be washing our feet, symbolically and probably literally. But obviously we're not talking about just that. What it means is actual service. One cannot believe they are loved by God without also realizing they are nothing before God. God's love should replace any kind of ego or selfish love we possess. We are loved by God so much so that we must die to ourselves and give up our lives in service of God by loving our neighbor and enemies. So I think in general, most of us might from time to time fall into one or both of those categories. There are times when we need our feet washed, we need to be reminded that God loves us, and we need to be loved by others. And there are other times when we need to wash someone else's feet. We need to be reminded that there isn't anything about us that makes us better than anyone else. And that if we claim to love God and be loved by God, then we need to die to ourselves and kneel down at the foot of the poor and despised. To take it further, we might need to actually become poor and despised as Jesus did, both in his birth and life. But also here in this scene, where he removes his outer garment and picks up the dirty feet and scrubs away. There are times we need to realize that most of the things we think are important, most of these things we think make us important, they amount to nothing. But there's a third way to look at this too, and that's where I want to spend most of my time. It's possible for a group to not only have traditions that change meaning, but it's possible for the very meaning of the traditions to change to the very opposite of their intent. And I think that a case could be made for the tradition of feet washing. And what immediately drew my attention to this passage was the interaction between Peter and Jesus. Jesus starts washing the disciples' feet, and he's pouring the water, he's got his makeshift apron on, and he gets to Peter. And for whatever reason, the writer has Peter exclaiming, "Never shall you wash my feet." And Jesus, apparently not batting an eye, replies, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." It makes sense that Peter kind of flipped out at the thought of having Jesus Christ wash his feet. As I said, Peter probably felt like he should be in Jesus' role, if anything. And maybe that's all it was for Peter. But I think for a lot of us today, it's a little more nuanced than that. I don't know how many of you have ever been through a foot washing service, but I've experienced a great deal of vulnerability and embarrassment while doing so. It's like getting your shoes shined or having someone clean up after you and do your dishes. You feel bad, like you should be cleaning up after yourself. I was staying in a hotel in Spain once, And the maid came in, and I don't speak any Spanish whatsoever, and she didn't speak any English whatsoever. And I didn't know how to tell her that I didn't want her to clean up because I had just woken up. So I was just kind of standing there. And I'm a pretty messy person, so there's sheets and pillows and clothes and cups and things all over. And so I couldn't tell her to come back later, so I just started cleaning and picking up as she did, and it was really, really awkward because we couldn't say anything to each other. And it's because I felt really embarrassed and I didn't know what to do. So when someone helps you or does you a favor or lowers themselves down below to wash your feet, so to speak, you start to notice everything wrong about yourself, and it's kind of humiliating. It essentially brings out your pride to the forefront, and if you're like me, you'll start to feel bad, not only for having someone do something for you, but you feel doubly bad because subconsciously you feel like you're being lazy, or that you think you're better than them. I don't know if anyone else thinks like that, but that's how I think. So I can only imagine I'd be all the more anxious, all the more humiliated, and all the more awkward having Jesus Christ, God of creation in the flesh, stoop down and wash my hairy, stinking feet. Jesus essentially held up a mirror to Peter's face, saying, "Take a good look at all your insecurities. Take a good look at your pride and your selfishness. It's one thing to help someone out. It's another thing to let someone help you out." And there does exist a lot of pride in our society. People don't want to think their accomplishments are anything other than their own doing. Or when everything hits the fan, they don't want people to listen or offer advice because they can do it on their own. I'm guilty of this, and a lot of us are. But there's a difference between feeling like you're too lowly to have your feet washed and feeling like you're too good to have your feet washed. Sometimes helping someone else out, lowering ourselves, actually makes us feel better than someone else. And what we need is to be helped by them. And this is kind of convoluted, so I'm going to try to be clear. If I'm someone who believes I should humble myself and wash someone else's feet, either literally or metaphorically, then I might feel prideful if that person, the one whom I'm helping, wants to help me. There's a certain amount of pride in knowing that you humbled yourself. And I think a lot of Christians are guilty of that pride. But I think the passage speaks to that too. We have a banner that talks about reconciliation. But reconciliation doesn't mean helping someone out and feeling good about yourself. It doesn't mean figuring out everyone else's mistakes and finding out a way to fix them. It doesn't mean solving some big systematic societal problem and making sure no one's poor anymore. It takes an acknowledgement on your part that you aren't above being loved by someone that society has said is incapable of love. Christians talk a lot about loving the other, the neighbor, the enemy. But what about letting the enemy love you? I'd imagine this is almost more difficult. It's one thing to love someone enough to confront them on something. It's another thing altogether to love someone enough that you allow them to love you and confront you when you've done something wrong. And you see this all the time when people do really well-intentioned charity. In all reality, it's not that hard to go to another country or paint a school or send a check every few weeks. It's not all that hard to take a few hours out of your day each week and go serve people food or visit a prisoner or sit with older folks. And these are very good and very necessary and helpful things. But they're easy to do, and they really only get at half of what it means to love someone if it just ends there with you going and helping. What's more difficult is to go visit a prisoner and be loved. To let them build you up, give you advice, tell you what you've done wrong. Giving something away or doing a service requires a minimal sacrifice, and a lot of times they allow us to keep others at a distance. Actually, lowering yourself in true humility means taking a risk. It means listening, learning, and allowing yourself to be convicted by something other than the poor state of the person you're helping. I try to imagine how it might feel if I went to hand out clothes to a homeless person or something like that, and they called me out on how many jackets and shoes and shirts I have, I'd probably get really defensive, like they crossed some invisible social barrier. And who were they to question me? I didn't have to give them anything. I didn't have to take time out of my busy day. But they'd be right to ask me those things, I think, in a Christian sense. Or if one of us went to another country and helped build a church, and they ask us how much of our money and time and worry went into our own building, or how we went about acquiring it, or how well we've maintained it, especially, we might feel kind of foolish. As we get excited thinking we're lowering ourselves and washing someone's feet who doesn't deserve our love. But we get uncomfortable when that person lowers themselves and washes our feet, because I think we still feel like that person doesn't really deserve our love and that we're above their love. I use a lot of the same words in this, so it gets kind of like I'm already getting confused. Is this making any sense whatsoever? Is it? Okay, good. I mean, in our context, it's not that hard to come over to the west side and clean up some graffiti or pick up trash or paint or build a house or talk with some neighbors. And it's not that hard to live over here either and feel like the location of your house is somehow an accomplishment for the kingdom. Again, these aren't bad things because there's a lot of trash that needs picked up and a lot of houses that need remodeled. And I think it would be great if more people made this part of town their home. But it's much more difficult to let someone in on your own personal baggage. It's a lot easier to love someone who hasn't been loved than it is to let someone who hasn't been loved love you. To only do the first part is not only half the gospel, but it's condescending, and it reinforces an us and them mentality. And it's all because we like the distance. We like feeling humble without being humbled. Realizing you're being humble will often make you feel pretty proud of how humble you are. And it's all become really systematized. I went to Anderson University, as a lot of you did, and I'm glad I did, because I met some really wonderful people there, professors and students who have radically changed my life. And while I was there, I was in charge of a group of students who went to the Pendleton Juvenile State Correctional Facility to mentor some of the offenders there. And I did this for 3 years, and I learned pretty quickly that any time I went in thinking I was somehow going to impact some kid's life and help him turn it all around, everything fell flat on its face. But I also couldn't go in pretending I was just this kid's friend and there wasn't anything different about our circumstances in life. He was in prison, I wasn't. He was brought up in a rough environment, I was brought up in an environment that was the opposite of rough in every way. I've never done drugs. He had. I went to college. He hadn't finished high school. There were cultural differences, socioeconomic differences, and educational differences, and the list goes on. The point is, we both had to acknowledge the fact that we were not the same in any of those ways. Until we did that, there was really no use in talking about anything else. But once we both came to terms with that, he with his insecurity and guilt about being in prison, and me with my insecurity and guilt for all of my privileges, we could speak to one another on each other's terms. Once that was out of the way, we were able to realize that despite all of those differences, we were really very similar on a primitive human level. Our fears, our desires, our sense of humor, they were all strikingly alike. And that's why I love that at least one of the disciples, Matthew, was a tax collector. He was not a poor fisherman, but a member of a group that was believed to be full of greed and worthy of scorn. Most Jews at the time hated tax collectors because they essentially took advantage of the poor for their own gain. Yet Jesus had tax collectors right alongside the violent zealots. He believed tax collectors not only deserved love, but that they were able to love others. It would be like having a convict and the judge that convicted him living and working and loving alongside each other. Doing so means both sides loving the other and letting the other love them. Once we acknowledge our differences, most of which are circumstantial and beyond our control, we can move past the pretense and have a mutual relationship. One is no longer the teacher and the other the learner, but both teach and learn to an equal degree. So it was strange to me that during my last year of mentoring, I was asked to keep a log of how many hours I went and visited and how many hours all of my volunteers went and visited too. Come to find out, the school compiled all of those hours so that they could put them up on a website and say, look how much our students volunteer. Look how much they care about the less fortunate. In other words, look how humble our students are. And I don't think AU is at all unique in that regard. Almost every school and church or church-affiliated institution loves to broadcast just how humble they can be, just how many feet they've washed over the years. And if you'd like to wash some feet, just join our group. Take a name tag, sign up when it's convenient for you. But I bet a whole lot of the administrators and board members and even pastors of those institutions would feel mighty uncomfortable at the thought of one of those kids at the state prison washing their feet. We can and have corrupted just about everything. We mandate baptism. We only allow certain people to take part in communion. And we can brag about our humility. I'm not talking about our church, but just the larger thing. So how do we recapture what Jesus was trying to teach us in his example of washing the disciples' feet? Sometimes I wonder where we're going and what we're moving towards as individuals and as just a global church and society. If someone were to ask me what the ultimate goal of the Christian life is, the end result, what it should be, I'm not sure I could give a straight answer. Even something like this, the washing of feet. We've come so far from the intention, turning from a daily way of life practice to a ritual that runs the risk of mocking the very idea from which it originated. It's as if we've taken the lesson, then tried to move further, only to end up back at the beginning, now in need of another lesson. Sometimes I feel like we've traveled so far away from where we've been called to go that there's no way we're going to find our way back. Even when we're doing what we believe we should be doing, loving others, loving God, lowering ourselves, it doesn't change the fact that things, people, will be taken away from us. I watch my friends and others try to do the right thing, try to fix themselves, and help others to try to do the same. And yet still things don't work out quite right. I think about our church and churches across the world who try to own up to mistakes and do the right things as they move forward. And they just can't seem to make it work the way they want to. Meanwhile, other people seem to go about things in a way that couldn't be further from the gospel, and they succeed right before our eyes. And it's in these times that I must be reminded that as Christians, we are not called to move in the direction of worldly success. We will never be able to change the fact that Jesus did not die heroically in a worldly victory. There's no way to spin it that way. Yes, he was resurrected, but that did not change the very real pain he felt in his last moments, nor did it change the very real pain, suffering, and death of his disciples. When Jesus washed the feet of the disciples, it did not eliminate any of the mystery, pain, or confusion they felt. It didn't make them understand any more or less what was going on and what was to come. Even Judas's feet were washed. And according to the text, Jesus knew about the betrayal and still washes his feet. He knew Peter was going to deny him when the time came, and he still washes his feet. The washing of the feet had no effect on the outcome. But the gospel has never been about a specific outcome. And maybe it's not about any outcome at all, but about who you are as someone who has a desire to follow Christ. We are commanded to wash each other's feet, to humble ourselves and serve and be served, to let others wash our feet, even if we think they don't deserve to. Not so that we can all be the same, not so that others will have what we have or know what we know, but because every moment of our lives presents an opportunity to experience the love of God and the love of the other in a way that surpasses our understanding of those words.